Okay, welcome back for the final hour here. Okay, the final point that I want to make about caching is, you know, the alternative. I mean, you put data in a blob, and it costs money to store there. And that costs the blob gets cost per the cost is based on the size and based on the transfers. Whereas compute instances, the cost is per the amount of disk that you have, and for the one and RAM, and so it's by the hour for the computation. And so the question is, I mean, we're geeks. That's what we do. We sit there and we calculate things, and we say, okay, where is the trade-off? And suppose you had a dedicated compute cache role that was sitting there to do kinds of stuff. As opposed to taking the things that are computed and sticking them in storage and then just handing out the storage. And the break-even is that your cache role has to serve at least 120 cache requests per hour, all right, to be cheaper than Azure storage. I mean, that's 2,000 per minute. That's, you know, it's getting on for, 30 per second or so. And that's a lot of computational resources. So pretty much all the time, blobs are going to be by far the most cost effective. If there's one thing I've learned since I've been doing all this Azure stuff is that the blobs just keep popping up, you know, and they keep popping up as the solution to this kind of problem, and that kind of problem, and you tend to use them a lot. And so the like I was saying with SQL Azure, you know, the very small size of the SQL Azure instances that you get, is Microsoft saying to you, we're not saying never do relational stuff, but we are saying don't just take your relational database and just bash it into the cloud. We're saying take it and think about it. Think about what should still be relational, what could be most more better taken out of relational and put into blobs, mostly. So, and that is a good thought exercise to go into. All right? Any comments on that?
No, I would agree.
Okay, and the last topic that we have here is Elastic Scale-Out. And, I just showed you these workflow patterns, on and off, growing fast, unpredictable, and predictable bursting. And the question is, all right, where and when and how do you figure out whether you need to have a compute instance and then start it up? And then when and how do you say, okay, well, I've got enough computation, let me turn some off. All right. Well, your load is going to vary. And sometimes there's more, sometimes a lot, sometimes there's less, you know, often none. That's the that's the on and off pattern. And how do you deal with that? Well, there's kind of two kinds of ways. You can either maintain some excess capacity, if that's what you want, keep a compute instance there spinning for somebody to come and start using it, or you can add more when you need it and remove it when you're finished with it, or some sort of a hybrid of the two. If you go, a lot of the times, I am really finding it very useful to think about the cloud according to that electrical analogy. If you look at electric utilities and you look at the load forecasting that they do, the different kinds of generation will have different costs. Nuclear, for example, once you have one built, doesn't cost very much to run, but it takes, days or even weeks to start it up, and then days or even weeks to shut it down when you're finished. On the other hand, natural gas turbine generation plants are relatively cheap to run. Relatively cheap to build compared to nuclear or coal. They can respond very quickly, right? If you need, you can turn it on and it will be up in half an hour, an hour, spinning out electricity. At the same time, the fuel is relatively expensive. It costs a relatively large amount to run while it's running. So it's quick to get up, but expensive to run as opposed to slow to get up and cheap to run once you get it there. So there is this notion of spinning reserve. That is to say, you've got so many plants putting out so many megawatts, and then you've got so much spinning reserve. That is to say, generation capacity that is up and spinning and ready for you to energize, but that you're not currently using. So if demand were to start coming up, what you would do is you would take some of that spinning reserve and start using it. And then if you were really on the ball, you would increase a few more to your so as to maintain that spinning reserve. I was even thinking of that when I saw how long it took to start up a compute instance, right? Because they've got to, they may well have to power up a PC. That could easily happen. Got to take a virtual machine, got to put it in. I was pondering the notion of a spinning reserve there, if you will, to have a, to have a virtual machine already set up, to have IIS already on it, and just quickly assign you one from the spinning reserve and let you put it on. That's essentially what you have, right? Once you've provisioned the machine, once you've uploaded the package, essentially you have your own spinning reserve machine. Actually, you're still getting charged for it, aren't you? Yeah.
You're charged all the time. So mm-hmm. the same
yes,
cost.
Yes. So, you know, if I don't think it would be that much harder if they had a certain spinning reserve of compute instances ready to go and then just stuck your package on them. And then the latency would be a lot less. Perhaps they would charge a little extra for the quick spinning up. Anyway, so yeah, async work pattern can provide a buffer. That's kind of what I was talking about. All right, so adding and removing additional capacity, it takes time to spin up. And it requires management. You have to think. Somebody has got to sit there looking and saying, well, gosh, you know, we're, the latency time, it took the guy way too long to buy the book. From the time he pushed the buy button, it took 10 seconds for the compute to come back. That's way too long. Heck, you know, spin up another compute instance. You've got to either do it based on time, or you've got to measure something, measure the response time, and do it based on that. So, you know, the load varies, and responding to variable load is one of the main things that you see here in Azure. Is kind of the one of the main things we were looking at doing. That was the original hook, was you can get out of the storage business and you can respond to variable load capacities. And now is where we're going to start thinking about where we're going to do it and how and when, right? How would you maintain, if you wanted to have a spinning reserve, if you wanted to have some extra headroom ready to get used, is you would run additional web roles. Well, that's, easy enough to do. You spin up a second web role and a third and a fourth. That's easy enough to do. What you have to do is you have to be monitoring it. You have to keep looking and saying, what was the latency the last time? How long did it take me to get this done? How long did the guy wait? If there's one thing you really don't want to do is when a guy's, I cursed out two bookstore managers within the space of half an hour at different bookstores last week, making me wait in a big long line to buy my books. And I said to them, look, there is a limit, and it's pretty damn small, for how hard I'm willing to bang my head against the wall to get you to take my money. So, you know, if you want somebody's money, it's a really good idea to make it easy for them to give it to you. So, all right. Now, for worker roles, So with web roles, there's a user there. A user is waiting, looking and saying, okay, what am I going to, come on, hurry up. I got to get on to my next thing. So by definition, there's a user there. They're going to respond to any sort of latency. And so you kind of have to be on the ball there. Well, now, worker role is a little different. Because remember, I showed you queues yesterday. We talked about the async pattern in queues. And so one possible thing that you can do with worker roles is if you don't want to spin up additional worker roles to do the work from the queue, well, you just buffer. The web roles take the work and they put it in queues, and they put some more in the queues, and they put some more in the queues, and the worker roles, you know, they churn them out as fast as they can. And as long as there's enough space in the queue, and, you know, we've got terabytes of space, that's not a real problem. You can do this. You can buffer these things into the queues. The question to answer here is, what level of latency can you tolerate? I call my credit card company to do something or other, and they say, we are experiencing an enormous, an unusual volume of calls. Funny how they always say that. Please leave a message if you like. Please leave a message and we'll call you back. Well, I never do that because I know I will get at the end of the queue and I won't get a call back for days. But what level of latency is tolerable? And so, you know, that's a business question, really. Customer is asking you to do something. How long is it okay to make the guy wait before he does it? When you sign up for the 30-day free trial that I mentioned at the beginning of this three-day talk, you fill out the form, you send it in, they say, okay, we've got it. We will be processing it. It may take up to 3 days for us to send you back your credentials. And I thought that was kind of annoying. I mean, when do I wait 3 days for anything, especially not online? Turns out it came back within, I think I got it 4 or 5 hours later. But, you know, there's something that gets shoved in. They tell you some amount of latency. It kind of annoyed the customer. On the other hand, they were giving me something free, so I couldn't get all that angry at them. And in fact, they came in well under the latency that they promised. Another business thought: under promise, over deliver. So, all right. So, and then if your queues are not clear and you keep an eye on your queue length, if the queue gets too long, well, then you spin up another worker role. Classic, you know, like at the drugstore, the cashier sees that there are too many customers waiting, says, please get cashier to the front. All right. So, now, if you're in storage, remember each storage node that you have, it has many partitions, and it's kind of up to Azure. Azure doesn't really, you don't design the way that Azure is going to load balance, is going to spin up requests for your storage. What you do, I can see you just about to wait, don't say that. What you do is you specify the partition. And you say, when you say the partition, I'll show you a code sample with this. That's kind of the last thing I'm going to do today. When you put things in a table, you specify a partition. And a partition is, if you think about it, is a load balancing unit. That is to say, everything that's in a partition, you want to be load balanced together. So all the data that is in partition A is data that's going to be used together, like your customers in Massachusetts might all be in partition A, perhaps, depending on the granularity of your business process and how you use it. In general, you will have relatively few partitions with relatively large amounts of data in them, basically the data that gets used together. If you've got data for children over here in partition A, you might have data for old people in partition B because they don't really get used together. And that tells Azure that Azure can split them apart if it wants to. In general, you don't have a whole lot of fine-grained control over that. Right? It's just one of those things. Back in Microsoft Transactions, remember that? We used to say let go and let Viper, which was the code name. Here you kind of, you know, once you've said what the partitions are, you got to kind of let go and let Windows Azure Storage. It'll more or less take care of things mostly. And if it doesn't, there's not a whole lot that you're going to be able to do to fix it. Isn't that something?
You just have to make sure that the partitions are not too small and not too big.
Because make sure they're not too small and not too big. That's
if
fair.
They are too big, then you will throw. Mm-hmm. If they're too small, so you will lose the scalability. Mm-hmm. So you have to be reasonable, mm-hmm. and you have to align those partitions with the querying. Mm-hmm. So you want to query inside a partition.
Query inside a partition, that's
so
absolutely right.
Align the partition with your business.
Align the partition with your business query. That's about what you can do. Right? Now in SQL Azure, you don't really get a loading indication. Like you can look at a queue and how many messages are in the queue now, how many queue messages are in the queue half an hour from now. It, you know, it's very, very easy to look at the queue and see how well you're doing. Oops, they were piling them up. Okay, now we're digging into the backlog. You know, very, very easy to see that in a queue. In SQL Azure, you really can't look at SQL Azure so much and figure out how it's doing. You kind of have to infer its performance by, you know, perhaps the messages in the queue or something. And the only way to get more performance in it is to, as you said yesterday, break it up into shards, which is more or less the same thing as partitioning, but with exactly. SQL Azure, right? So hopefully before the Christmas selling season, then your web server crashes in the middle of it, but that's all right. So, Azure, SQL Azure, fine. Wonderful. How do you add capacity? Well, we've talked about that. You can have more instances. The config file specifies how many instances there are. Okay, now there's one. Okay, now there's five. And if you change, if you go to the config file, suppose the config file says two, and you go to the config file and change it to say five, well, the existing ones stay running, and it spins up three more, so it won't shut down. What you can't easily change, and I find this a little bit funny, is you can't really change to using larger VMs. You have to redeploy then. On the one hand, I mean, I find it just a little bit surprising that can't easily be done on the fly. On the other hand, that probably isn't what you're looking to do, right? As I said earlier, there is no extra cost. You know, if you're going to run eight small instances, eight 1x instances in Azure, it does cost you exactly as much as running one 8-core instance. And unless they're all operating on the same data, it doesn't save you anything. So I am coming to the conclusion that an extra large instance, or even a large one, is relatively rare that it is advantageous. Would you agree or disagree with that? I mean, that's kind of a new, the thought process that I went through in preparing for and delivering this talk is what's leading me there. And so I'm
It just depends on what you do, because mm-hmm. again, when you're dealing with the same data, you don't want to have communication between.
That's true. You don't want communication between the instances. But my thought is, most of the time, you don't want so much communication between the instances.
If things are relatively independent, so you can look at it as hypercomputing. In hypercomputing, you spin up many instances, and they all work in parallel. And by the end of it, you take and sum all the results together. If that's your case, you're correct.
Mm-hmm. And they're encouraging you to do that. The structure of Azure and the economics are leading you in paths of righteousness, as it were. So I like that. All right. So adding capacity there, adding capacity to the storage is opaque to the user. It is the partitions again. Partition aggressively, particularly in tables, particularly in SQL Azure, which the small size of the instance is going to insist on. Blobs are done automatically. Use the content download network if you possibly can. And the thing will scale out nicely with you.
What's important to discuss. Is
all right.
Who is in charge of adding new capacity?
Who is in charge of it?
When you add new capacity, you pay more money.
When adding new capacity to what?
When I spin a new instance,
yes,
the company will pay more money.
Ah, yes. Okay. We're going to come to that talking.
We're talking about spinning new instances, etc.
Yes, that's true. Okay, we can talk about it now.
We're speaking about that. We can do it automatically using the API. We can do it automatically via scripting.
Mm-hmm.
We can do it just by changing the configuration file.
Somebody's got to be doing that. Somebody's got
to
be looking at it.
Someone has to do it, and someone has to have the authority to do so.
Somebody has to have the authority to do so. Somebody has to calculate the algorithm. Somebody has to say, yes, we are a fancy store, and we will bring up a new cashier when there are two people waiting. Or no, we are the Family Dollar store in downtown Ipswich. Our prices are very low. In return, we treat you like something. Some of you scrape off the bottom of your shoe, and therefore, no, we will not bring out any more. We're going to make you wait in line like this. Not at Borders when I'm paying full price. You're not. You bunch of.
Okay. Now I'm asking when. I spin up a new thread.
Yes.
When a developer spins up a new thread, who is responsible for that new thread? Well, the developer is. The developer just spins up a new thread. He decides, I want to execute something on a new thread. Mm-hmm. Nobody else around the company knows about that.
Yeah.
Just a developer business. Mm-hmm. He creates a new thread, and that's it. Now, when you spin a new instance, well, in the budget office, they will know about it.
Somebody's going to say, wait a minute, man, look how much more you spent.
Someone will
make
pay
those darn
for this.
Customers wait in line instead.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it cannot be only the responsibility of the developer
of course
to
not.
Spin a new instance.
Absolutely.
So here we have the IT pro coming into the business. The IT pro and the developer has to be aligned in some way in the design. in the IT pro has to give a certain limit to the amount of instances that the developer can spin up, because it's just impossible to tolerate a situation where developers will just create instances on the fly without any control on that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when I think about the two roles, I think of the developers as the guys in the back room who write the programs, and the IT guys are the guys who sit there and say, okay, I'm going to start one, or I'm going to start another one. To my way of thinking, the dev isn't really in that equation. That is most of the IT guys. But now that you mention that, there's talking spinning up threads, an idea springs to mind here. Figuring out that creating a thread is relatively expensive. Getting rid of a thread is relatively expensive, relatively high overhead. There is in T, this thing, or in .NET, this thing called the thread pool. And you throw... They're called work items. You throw them into the thread pool. It's basically an object with a callback function. You put them in a queue, basically, and the thread pool manages the number of threads. The thread pool itself manages the number of threads that it assigns to the job. It looks at the throughput it's getting. It looks at the latency of the work items. It looks how long the work items are blocked waiting for things. So I have a sample that I don't really have time to run here, but if you have work items that run to completion, I just have a big four. This is when I teach threading, you know, my Harvard class or somewhere. When I teach threading, I start with a work item that just spins and spins and spins in an infinite loop, four semicolon semicolon for, you know, for I equals one up to a gazillion, etc. And the thread pool will run two or three of them at a time because it notices that they're not blocked waiting for anything. It is smart enough to know that assigning more threads on the CPU that it has will not get it done any faster. On the other hand, if I put in some blocks, if I make them go around a loop and then sleep for a second, go around a loop and then sleep for a second, the thread pool will determine, aha, these things are sleeping, and then spin up more threads so as to keep the CPU in constant usage. And so there is a thread pool. There is an object in the .NET framework whose job that is to do. It occurs to me to wonder whether such a thing could be really useful for Azure to automatically look up how well the instances are being employed and how much work each one of them is doing, and no doubt within a budget that you would set, you know, don't spend more than X amount per day or whatever.
There was a question here, is it easy to automate? And the answer is yes.
It is relatively easy to start them. It's relatively easy to shut them down.
Yes.
It's relatively easy to read the parameters that one would think about to read, you know, the number of messages in a queue. How you take the information about the number of messages in a queue, how you figure out how much it's costing you for each minute that they stay there, how much you figure each one is worth, the business computation job is quite possibly very difficult.
Of course.
Very easy to fetch the information, very easy to act on the information once you've decided to do. Taking the information, thinking about it, and deciding what to do is, you know, it can be as difficult as anything.
Of course. But the API is simple?
The API is simple, absolutely. Okay. All right, let's see. SQL Azure, we talked about, you know, add more databases, more partitions. You know, it's hard to achieve in midstream. Oh, my goodness, everybody's buying my toys for Christmas. Quick, you know, spin me up in the next half hour. Well, no, it doesn't, you know, that's not kind of what it is. It's brittle, wouldn't you say? The SQL Azure is more brittle than the Windows Azure storage. Would you use that term?
Maybe.
In this sense, I think I would say that. All right. And here, this is what I was talking about, getting to rule-based scaling, service management, and diagnostic APIs. You look and you see how many messages are in the queue. Okay, that's one thing. Or you can turn it on and off based on time. Subway.com here, it's 11 o'clock here. All right, we'll spin up three instances to handle the lunch rush. All right, it's 1 o'clock, we'll throttle them down, et cetera. You know, it's not free. The metrics that we talked about, it's anytime anybody talks about metrics, it's my favorite story about metrics, right? If you can't measure it, you can't manage it. A major automotive company whose name I probably better not mention, their engine plant was being monitored, was being measured on the pounds of metal that were poured, kilograms of metal perhaps, that were poured. They made engine castings. And so when they were behind on quota, they would on the ground and look, we made our quota. We poured all this amount of metal. And of course, you know, the engine castings weren't any good. Wait a minute, we're practicing statistical quality control. Why are we still losing money? Well, they had their own quality metric. When they switched the quality metric to net good casting shipped, you know, the good of the casting you sent out the door minus the ones that came back for rework, then they started measuring something that was more useful and more helpful, and then they started being able to see what effect the different strategies they would have on whether it went up or down. So you know, you really have to think about just what exactly you were looking at. How do you measure whether you've done a good job or not? You can measure the actual work done, the request done per second, or the queue messages processed. You can look at, and to me, that's what I like to see, because that's what you're actually getting paid to do. Everything else, to my way of thinking, is an indirect way of getting it. You look at CPU utilization, you look at queue length, that is somewhat secondary. Response time, to some extent you get paid for response time. Sometimes the customers throw up their hands and leave and buy from Amazon if your response time isn't good enough. Derivative metrics, the rate of change of the queue length. The line is building really quickly now. You see what I mean, what I meant when I said that, yes, you can get the information very easily. You can tell Azure, you know, to spin up an instance or shut one down very easily. But figuring out what it is you want to do can be as complicated as you care to make it. And there's a really good example. We talked about diagnostics. You talked about diagnostics the other day. That's where you get them, et cetera, et cetera. Business rules, again, you know, the IT guy and the business guy is going to come in here. The business guy is going to, you look at Walmart, for example. I try not to go to Walmart, but the cashier lines are pretty long. And somebody at Walmart thinks very carefully about what is their optimum length of cashier line. There are guys who do nothing but analyze these kinds of things. You know, how long will somebody wait in the cashier line? Another thing that you would see, you know, you think of your business rules, you'll have different queues. The queue, that was one of the problems they were having at Borders. They didn't have a separate return desk. The returns were being processed at the cashier. Right? So somebody's waiting for you to give you your money, and they were delaying it, and somebody getting their money back. You know, at Walmart, they always send you to the service desk, which has a much longer line. And they say, well, you know, you want to give us your money? Yes, that's really easy. You want to get it back? Harder. And so, again, business, that is as much of a business calculation as anything. It's kind of outside the realm of us computer geeks, wouldn't you say? All right. So we talked about that. Manage momentum. Be careful not to overshoot. Oh, I don't know. Depends. If you overshoot a little too high, you've burned a little bit of money. You'll come back too soon. You overshoot a little too low. Well, now you've annoyed customers and sent them elsewhere. That's a whole lot worse, it seems to me. Okay, and that is about what I have to say about elasticity. We talked about scaling out rather than up, and there's not a whole lot of up to scale. It's pretty much out. In order to do that, you have to remove bottlenecks. You have to remove shared dependencies. It's a fun place to be, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's the cloud.
All right, so that's what I have to say about that. All right, my last and final piece. You know, we just the last piece that I have to do is the walkthrough of the table sample. Before I do that, I had just a few questions that came in the early days that I said we would postpone until the end. It is now the end, so I'm going to get them out, and we'll just look. One guy asked, "Is it possible to replicate data from SQL Azure to a local instance of SQL, and is that a hard thing to do?"
Yes.
And yes, it is possible.
It is possible using DataSync.
That's right. You showed us that.
Yes, it is possible to synchronize both ways.
Okay, using DataSync. Okay, that one's easy. All right. How to connect locally hosted services from the cloud? So you're in the cloud, and the cloud wants to call a locally hosted service. I don't know. That strikes me as just a straight web service thing. You give it a proxy. It makes a call.
If your service is exposed.
If your service is
out
exposed.
There. To the web.
Yes.
So, like anybody else, your cloud service can use it.
You're a cloud service. You're just a client. I mean, it is completely
exactly.
It is completely orthogonal to the. I love that word. Teaching my 7-year-old the word orthogonal was one way. I'm a geek. I can't help it. You know.
A service, if it is accessible,
right.
Well, it doesn't really know who is its client, so it doesn't really care if the client sits on the cloud or sits mm-hmm. somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got that one taken care of. Nightly builds. Somebody asked, how do you do nightly builds? And said, here, see an article by Grace Mollison, somebody was suggesting for nightly
yeah,
builds.
So,
have you seen that one? What'd you think of it? I haven't read that particular
Nightly builds. Nightly builds means like automation and scripting.
Yes.
Yes, it is possible to integrate scripting, PowerShell scripting, etc., to mm-hmm. the nightly build. So, yes, you can do so. Even though I would argue that you would want to actually deploy things outside of your corporate network mm-hmm. when you build. Your build is only while you're developing your code. So the nightly build might, using CSPAC and CSRun, might deploy the stuff inside using the emulators, mm-hmm. run the emulator, and see that everything works great. This is possible,
mm-hmm.
And this is part of the automation capabilities of Windows Azure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. And you know, will we spend some time discussing how best to leverage Silverlight as a user client? I was willing to answer that question very easily by saying no. When you started, but you had something to say about that last night when we discussed it.
When Silverlight Silverlight wants to access a certain blob, let's say a certain
yes.
certain piece of storage, there's an issue of cross domain.
That's it. It was cross domain scripting. That was the problem.
And yes, it is possible. I don't have the time now to show the details,
mm-hmm.
But it is possible. I would write a post about it and describe in details
okay.
how it is done.
Mm-hmm.
But it is possible to instruct blob storage and storage in general to accept cross-domain requests. Mm-hmm. And so Silverlight can access blobs information stored in blob storage.
Okay, cool. And finally, any particular tips for teams of developers?
What does it mean?
I don't know. It seems to me everything we've been saying has been applicable to teams. I guess nothing specific for teams that we haven't already said.
I don't understand the question.
Me neither, but that's what I had. Okay. So those are the questions, the backlog that we had. And so now let's go through this last code sample, and then we'll wish these good people good evening and Godspeed. So,
Merry
right.
Christmas.
And Happy New Year. And... So let me go share out my desktop. All right. There we go. All right. What I have here is the download that you will get here. I've got you'll have a folder called Storage, probably on the second day. This one is Exploring Windows Azure Storage Visual Studio 2010. In that, you will find here. You'll find under Source, there, you'll find example 01 working with tables. There was a blob and a drive and all that, and queues, which I did not use in this example. So that's where you'll find this particular one, example 01 working with tables. I'm going to the end. I'm just go straight to the here. You open end.solution. If you do that, what you will get is you will get this. And I started with the hands-on lab, and what I did is I very carefully rearranged the code so it was easy to read and added lots and lots of comments, so each piece is self-explanatory. All right, what we have here, let's go look in the Windows Azure Storage here in the development. What we've got now here is a table, and this is a guestbook application there. And here's a table whose name is Messages. If you look in here, here's a partition key, there's a row key, there's a timestamp, there's a body, and there's a name, like that. All right? So that's a table of messages to put in a guest book. If I spin it up here, all right. my name. I can't even spell my name. It's getting to be Friday afternoon. My message here is a pointless message. Okay, I click submit. This is going to add this to the table, and then it is going to refresh its display from the contents of that table. If I was really interested, I would have it refresh its contents at the very beginning and show you what was in the table. I was too lazy to do that. I'll just keep going. We'll come back and look at the code a little later. All right, there it is. Platsky said this. Here is a pointless message. There's that other message string that you had there. There's that there's that other message that you saw here. If you come back to the Storage Explorer like this, and if you refresh it, well, anyway, you can see it's in there because the...
Over here and refresh.
Where? I did that once.
Or just...
Yeah, it'll show up, don't worry. Let's keep on going. It's Friday afternoon, okay? All right, let's go... you know what? If I shut it down... Let's go shut it down. And... Eventually... Well, eventually it'll show up. If I...
You can shut the Server Explorer.
It's in there. All right, let's go look at this code. All right, what we have, we go look in... what's important to see here, this is the table. And in every table, for every entry that you have in a table, you have to have a partition key, and we talked about that. And the partition key is the partition key... tells SQL Azure, it tells Windows Azure Storage how to clump this data with other pieces of data. And it's items with the same key, it tells SQL Azure to keep them together. All right. So in general, you will have a relatively small number of partition keys. Row key, that is like the ID of the specific of this row of data, and that needs to be unique within the table. And you can see what I have here is I have a tick count and then a GUID, so that will make sure that this is good and unique. It also has a timestamp when this thing was put in, so it has to have all three of those. And then it has whatever other properties you want to put into it. And so for this guestbook application, what I have is I have a body, the message that I've put in, and the name, the guy that put the comment in. All right? So, so that's what my table looks like. Now, how do I write the code that does this kind of thing? Let's go look. All right? Now, you remember that I said yesterday that when you do this, yes, this could be anything, but the simplicity of using some of the ADO.NET context objects and things like this are going to lead you to something that looks, feels, works pretty much like a classic table. Some of the column entries, some of the columns may be optional and you won't have them there, but you know, this is not going to be the complete freeform property bag that some of the documentation seems to suggest. So the first thing that I like to start with here is to figure out the message. And a message like a row. If I'd have called this table rows, it would have been, to my way of thinking, it would have been a little more obvious. But this came out of the hands-on lab entitled messages, and I didn't feel like making that big a change at that particular time. So this message thing, if you think about it, it's like a row, right? Here. So this is my row class here, right? So class message, and there's my name, and there's my body. I put properties on it for the pieces that I'm adding to it. Now, this base class here, table service entity, here, go look at this. Look at this base class, right-click, go to definition. Here, there's my partition key. There's my row key, there's my timestamp. So if I derive from this class, I can specify in my message class just the things that I'm adding, and I will inherit these three pieces that the that every row entry needs to have. Okay, inheritance sort of gets a bum rap these days, but to my way of thinking, this is a very good way of, this is exactly what it's for. Right? When somebody instantiates a message, I just hardwire in a partition key. In practice, you're going to think a lot more carefully about that. My point here is that what I've done here is I'm saying, okay, all of these messages are in the same partition, right? And everything that messages are connected to, perhaps if I had users, a table of users and which registered users and which users had put in which message, and I would say, okay, which messages were put in by this user? I'm doing queries on these same tables, so I would keep these same tables in the same partition. So, all right, there's the row key. And remember, row key has to be unique. So again, I think I lifted this from the blob sample because they had gone out of their way to make the blob name unique. So it's really simple. You get the ticks, you know, the date and time converted into timer ticks. So that's, you know, pretty unique on its own. And then you also generate a brand new GUID. And man, if that's not unique, I am out of ideas, okay? You know, that's just... so anyway, when somebody instantiates a new message, there they get this object, it's got a name, it's got a body, a partition key, a row key, and it puts in its own timestamp, which is kind of nice. Base class does a timestamp if you feel like going and looking at the code. All right, so that's my message. All right. And now let's go look at the submit button. Here's my default.aspects here, there. User here, I type in. Like so. You click the submit button there. Okay, here we are. Okay, start with an empty string there. There's my cloud storage account. I go fetch my cloud storage account from the configuration setting. If I sort of don't really have time right now on Friday afternoon, I'd say the table... the table is set up in the startup code. All right, you can't just go banging things into a table until you have a table. Now here is there's this thing called a message data, called a data service context. And again, this is one of the things that that you get from EDO.net that are so easy to use that you're going to want to use them a lot. Here, I have to write, right here, message data service context here. This is a class that I wrote. Message data service context derives from table service context. That's a, there it is, Microsoft.Windows.Azure.StorageClient.TableServiceContext. If you right-click here and go to the definition, you'll see there are many here and in the base class of this system.data.services.dataServiceContext, there's save changes either without retries. If you go into the base class here, again, there's credentials, there's merging, there's resolving, there's timeouts, there's tunneling, there's reading, there's writing, there's adding objects. All of these nice things that you get from the base class that I really just don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about right now. There. All right, I'll have to go do it again because I sat there talking for too long. There. Okay, get my storage account there. Instantiate a new data context. And say, here is where there's my storage account. That's where you find the tables. Here are my credentials. So this is what the data context needs to reach into my storage account. It knows its location. It's got its credentials. This is what the data context needs to reach into my storage account and put things there. All right. Now, data context, add a message. I give it the text here, the text there. And now in my data context, I've written this add message, right? Let me go through the, let me switch to the data context here. There's a method that I wrote here, add message, give it the name and the body. Here, instantiate a new object of class message, sending its name and body property onto what I passed on. Here, add objects to the table whose name is messages. Go add a new message whose contents are these, and save the changes. So it's here in my data context. The data context is a generic thing. It will add an object of any class. My message data service context knows how to save messages and not anything else. Right? So that's how I put it in. Now, when I want to get it out, when I want to show it here, I put on a property called messages, property that I wrote. It returns an object of iQueryable wrapped around a message. And here, return create query, that's a base class, for messages in this table. So here, go to the table whose name is this, and do a query for objects of that class, please. So that's how I fetch out of the table. And here, there I am, make a new context. Yeah. Here I'm making a new context. Hey, Mr. Context, add this message. Now, I want to go fetch the messages that are there. I go to that list control. I go to this list control and say, here's your data source. Those are the messages in the table, and bind to them, and that's how they get shown. So you see how easy it is to reach into the tables and do regular data stuff with it. So, hey, you guys, it's Friday afternoon. And I'll bet you could use a cool one. Because I know I sure could. Well, no, it's been a pleasure working with you. I learned a lot of stuff here. I hope we can do it again sometimes. You guys out there in TV land, if either one of us can be help to you, give us a call. You know where to find us. We're on the web. And until we meet again, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Thank you. Good night.